DM Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Coming to you live today, July 13, 2008. Sorry for the delayed introduction, and sorry if there's a little bit of technical difficulty sometimes with my microphone today. We're working on some new systems here at WILL, and hence the delay. But it's a show worth waiting for, and we're going to be taking callers, so thank you for joining us. Our guest today is Tom Hayden, the seminal 1960s activist, co-founder of SDF, and then longtime political commentator, activist, and author, author of a number of highly acclaimed books, including Ending the War in Iraq, as well as a member of the California State Legislature for nearly two decades in the 1980s and 1990s. Currently an author, a teacher, a professor who writes regularly on politics for the Huffington Post. It's an honor to welcome Tom Hayden to Media Matters. Tom?
Thank you, Bob. Nice to be here.
Well, it's great to finally get here. We've been trying to get here for a long time.
My Sundays are complicated.
Well, and I appreciate that people take time off on their Sundays, and our listeners do as well, to join us on the show. You know, you come to American politics with, at this point, a vantage point of nearly five decades of involvement in activism. And I just mean, before we get into too much detail on Iraq and current politics, your sort of general sense of where America is politically right now, 2008, this moment, compared to, say, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, what do you see are there changes you see, or are things basically the same? What's your assessment in broad terms of our current situation?
Well, I think it's America is a work in progress, over a 500-year period. There are some who emphasize our special qualities like democracy and human rights. There are others that emphasize our genocidal beginnings. But what I see is a repeated story of social movements gaining ground against entrenched, I call them Machiavellian forces, for want of a better word. And it's unending. You know, in Christianity or Marxism, there's always an end. You know, protagonist, antagonist, good, evil, synthesis. But here, obviously, it's a constant process of forwards and backwards. With respect to where we are now, I think this election is pretty important because we have a 50-50 difference between those who want to preserve the status quo in the war on terror and on other levels of the status quo, and those who want to change it in somewhat undefined ways. And the outcome of these elections loses you or gains you a lot of time and a lot of space. You know, I've always wondered if our present economic system could be reformed to include serious environmentalism. If Gore had been elected in 2000, we would know something by now that we don't. So that's where we are. I think if we had not had the murders of the 60s, the new left might have been part of a majority coalition that would have come to power, so to speak, electing a president, Congress, perhaps ending the Vietnam War. So on balance, the same struggle continues, but on the one hand, the suffering has been very great, very great. The gains are often not felt to be worth all the investment, but in the long view, the gains, like the work that's being done to avoid the corporate domination of the media, justify the effort. No, I mean, it's not easy.
No, it isn't. Tom Hayden, you wrote an essay, co-authored an essay several months ago that appeared in the Huffington Post and got wide circulation, basically endorsing the Obama campaign. You co-authored it with, as I believe, Barbara Ehrenreich and is it Bill Fletcher?
Bill Fletcher.
Yeah.
Danny Glover,
and you were making the case there that progressives, people in the political left, organizers, activists, should throw their qualified support behind the Obama campaign. But if you would, for the sake of our listeners who are not familiar with that piece, just elaborate on that argument.
Well, I'm very impressed by the Obama campaign. It's reached deep into my family, my son, his wife, little kid. You know, the volunteers, they remind me of, this is a phenomenon that's hard to describe as a social movement because it's built around a candidate, but stranger things have happened. It is, in fact, a social movement that was unexpected, unpredicted, and we haven't seen anything like this since the Bobby Kennedy campaign of 1968. My instinct, my gut is whenever you see, you know, the African-American community unified like this and a whole new generation of young people from different backgrounds unified like this, it's a harbinger of change. It's a sign. And that's why, you know, I totally embrace and endorse the phenomenon. Well, on the other hand, we might quarrel, and as I do, with some of Barack Obama's positions, which I think is what justifies having a network of progressives for Obama, which you can find out more about at progressivesforobama.blogspot.com.
In recent weeks, Tom, Barack Obama has made what pundits call a move to the center or to the right on campaign finance spending, on the Iraq War, on the FISA vote that just came in the Senate last week. Did this surprise you? Did it disappoint you? Does it change your analysis in any way?
I still don't know really whether it was simultaneous and accidental, or whether it was planned by the Obama campaign, or whether it was framed by the media. I'm not sure how it happened, but, while it's not devastating, I don't think it was a good thing at all, and particularly his vote on the wiretapping, the electronic surveillance, where he had once opposed it and said he would filibuster it, and then voting for it as the lesser evil, I guess is how he put it. The reason I say this is I have no objection to a presidential candidate running in the center. I mean, I'm not deluded into thinking that Americans are going to elect a left-wing president. But there's ways to be in the center. You could say, unlike what you think of some liberal Democrats, I favor small business, community-based business, entrepreneurs. There's things you could do, but this particular vote went right against the passions of one of his core constituencies, and so if he was unaware of that, that's disturbing. If he was aware of it, that's disturbing. What it means for the future is he's at risk. I think you can look at my writings on that. I mean, it's a kind of a at-risk candidacy now because his base includes some of the democratic institutions like SEIU and labor, but it really is an unusual base in that it's composed of people who have very, very strong beliefs, who put their faith in him, and so it's deep, but it's fragile, and so anything that suddenly makes Barack Obama appear to be not who we thought he was can create a kind of buyer's remorse among a lot of voters, and therefore put him at risk. I don't know if that's happened, but at the risk of being mistaken, I'm saying it has happened, and somebody really has to address it before it worsens, because there's so much stake on this election. And I think right now, somebody in his campaign must believe that they're positioning himself to reach independent voters, conservative voters, but they shouldn't be taking the risk of playing into the Republican machine that wants to describe him as just another politician and rub some of the stardust off of him and make him seem no different than McCain, which is actually the front page article in today's L.A. Times. I don't know if you've seen it, that their
not
positions
yet
are drawing closer together, which I don't think is true. But if that's the spin, then some people will vote for McCain, thinking that it doesn't really matter because he's not that different from Obama.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Come to you live today. If you'd like to call in and speak with our guests, the number is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. And our guest, of course, Tom Hayden, former state senator from California, co-founder of SDS, storied political activist for now 5 decades, author of numerous books, including the recent Ending the War in Iraq, and a frequent writer and commentator for the Huffington Post. It's a pleasure to have Tom Hayden with us today. Tom, speaking of John McCain, what is your take on the state of the Republican Party today and the McCain candidacy and what it represents?
Well, looking at it from the outside, I think they made a brilliant move in choosing McCain. He's a hard man to beat. I say that because he has an image that is deeply resonant in American culture as a kind of Eisenhower, who really suffered in war for his country and is cranky, eccentric, independent, and very appealing, I think, for better or worse, to independent voters. There's no other way that I can think of that the Republicans could have made a comeback in a year that should be an overwhelmingly Democratic advantage.
Do you, so far, what you've seen of McCain on the trail for the last couple of months, has it pretty much confirmed your assessment that he's going to be a strong candidate?
He is a strong candidate because he's floundering, and he's still only 3 to 8 points behind Obama in a context that favors Democrats. And you know, once he gets his footing and this cranks in, he starts with 40% who are going to vote for him come what may, and he only needs to instill a sense of doubt about who Barack Obama is among another 10-12% of the voters, and he's got it. So I don't think the Democrats or the left have exactly found a way, I certainly haven't, to characterize what McCain means that will be effective with those independent voters, because his character symbolism is so strong. There must be something, it's being tried, but I don't think just railing against him and saying that he's more of Bush quite makes sense to the independent voters, which the election is about.
You know, one of the things that...
You're the media expert. I mean, I think he's a perfect media candidate.
Well, yes, and we've had guests on the show already who've talked about McCain and press coverage he receives and how he is a golden boy with the press corps and the type of coverage he gets, or doesn't get in the case of gas, that other candidates would be choked on, and he somehow sails right by them with Teflon. you talked about how Obama should win. This should be a Democratic year, and 2006 was very much a Democratic year. Yeah, the Congress, the House and Senate votes nationally look to be going Democratic. Most of the state races trending Democratic. Do you think we're in the midst of a not just a bump in the road with a bad war and a recession, but something maybe more profound in terms of realignment of politics in this country?
I would hope so, but it's, I think it's it remains to be seen. It's we are at what I would call, or you would call, a progressive populist moment on the issues of the war, the domestic spine, the corporate domination, the deregulation of the economy, the trade agreements like NAFTA, CAFTA, WTO, all those in question, not to mention the the looming shadow of environmental destruction. So if somebody can put it together into, you know, a proper framework with three or four issues, certainly there seems to be a 50 to 65% American majority. And yet sometimes it takes a great while to achieve the majority will. Sometimes, you know, the issue of health care has been on the Democratic agenda for 50 years. The issue of the women's right to vote took 100 years of struggle. Every time there's a gain like civil rights and voting rights in the South, there are reversals to weaken or contain the reform. So I think it's more accurate to say that we're a country that's, you know, at a very big crossroads than to say the shift has already taken place. Remember, only 2-3 years ago, the crazy pundits were saying there's a permanent Republican realignment.
True indeed. Our guest, Tom Hayden. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. You're listening to Media Matters. Let's go to our phone lines now. Our first caller here, line 4, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling from Urbana and wondering if your guest has any thoughts on Obama's upcoming choice of running mate, and I'll listen to the comments off the air. Thanks.
Thank you very much, caller. Tom?
If you go to our website, there's commentary, most of it as uneducated as my thoughts. That's a closely guarded secret. It seems to me Webb from Virginia might have been a possibility. Richardson of New Mexico, good possibility. I'm thinking here of who can add a state that Obama might not.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hillary is a remote possibility. Maybe somebody like Chuck Hagel from the other party, who's an anti-war Vietnam vet, going to Iraq with Obama, will certainly raise speculation about Hagel. But I think he has to take into account some of his perceived weaknesses, experience, etc. But also, uppermost is whether a candidate, a vice presidential candidate, can bring a state on board that Obama can't. And I don't know the answer to that.
You know, Tom, let's go to the Iraq War, since you just referred to the fact that Obama and Hagel may be traveling there. You wrote a book about this, ending the war in Iraq. The Iraq War has played a role in this campaign, of course, with Obama getting a good deal of his initial
support. He got his launch, yeah, absolutely.
Because of his stated opposition to the war versus Hillary in particular. And now we have John McCain saying that the war is a success and saying that's his issue, no longer Obama's issue. What's your take on Iraq right now?
Well, I think also the long answer would involve looking at, you know, my posts on Huffington Post, The Nation, and so on. But the short answer is you know, that those who want to maintain dominance in Iraq and Afghanistan have been planning to be in survival mode throughout this whole year, because they're well aware that the American people could stampede them out of Iraq by electing a president with an overwhelming mandate. And so, the papers today are full of talk that Bush might withdraw a few more divisions. It's all about quelling American public opinion and taking the issue away from Obama. I hate to be brutally candid, but wars are fought at home, as Republicans like to say when they blame Democrats, and it's absolutely true. So I think the anti-war movement needs to take satisfaction in the arrival of a strong and solid anti-war consensus in public opinion, try to inject itself into the campaigns this fall where anti-war voters might make a difference in a Senate race or in a congressional race. And above all, do everything that we can to defeat McCain, because he represents the continuation of the neoconservative game plan and the Pentagon's game plan. Having said that, the most that can be expected, and it's going to be very close, is a strong voter mandate for Barack Obama, in which the voters mandate peace and perceive that Obama is the one to do it. Then we get into the very sticky business of whether Obama will keep to his word in withdrawing combat brigades. And then the question, the media, and I really wanted to emphasize this today, the media default failure, utter failure, has been to ask what happens if combat troops are withdrawn, because under the Obama plan, Iraq would look like Central America in the 1970s. There would be 10 or 20,000 advisors, trainers, counterterrorism units, and to back them up, you'd have to have an additional 25,000. So you'd have you'd have 50,000 American troops stationed there in a completely unstable situation, fighting on whose side, it remains unknown. It's not a... It's a plan to go from combat to counterinsurgency. That's what it is. And the counterinsurgency is quite brutal. Currently in Afghanistan and Iraq, there are 100,000 detainees incarcerated without charges, without lawyers, without family contacts, in violation of all international human rights standards. It's going to be, at best, a two-step process with Obama.
Our guest, Tom Hayes.
You're in the middle of a crisis of democracy versus the national security state, right? I mean, in Iraq, 80% of the people want us out within a year.
Mm-hmm.
In America, 60-65% want us out within a year. The majority of the Congress want us out within a year. The majority of the Iraqi parliament want us out within a year. And yet, the elites who like to think that they really run things are doing everything possible to get through this year, hopefully electing McCain, but in any event, keeping their military project in Iraq alive until we get it away from elections and we back into 2009 and on it goes. So this is a painful lesson. It can make people turn very negative, and I do not mean to imply that at all. I just think when we talk in the rhetoric of long-term struggle, we have to understand that it's really true. These are long-term battles.
Our guest, Tom Hayden. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Let's go back to our phone lines right now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, do you have any ideas about what kind of Supreme Court nominees that Obama might propose in light of his recent vote on FISA?
I can't hear you. It was about court nominees in light of what, please?
In light of his vote on FISA, the recent FISA.
If I can paraphrase for the caller, Tom.
I got you.
Yeah, what prospective Supreme Court nominees a President Obama might have?
Well, I don't think that his vote on the FISA predetermines how he'll think about it if he becomes president. But it'll be a battle. He will be elected, if he is, in part because of a public revulsion against the Supreme Court in 2000 and the Bush appointees, and so many people will feel any choice is better than what we have, especially if the choice shows signs of independence, thoughtfulness, balance, and so on. It's also true that the courts, have been, believe it or not, more progressive on these wiretap measures than the congressional or executive branch. So any improvement on the court is liable to move it in a direction, you know, more supportive of individual liberties. So I think it'll be better, but as to whether he'll appoint, he'll make that a key issue to reverse his Senate vote, who knows?
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest is Tom Hayden, the author, commentator of Huffington Post, and going back five decades, co-founder. Excuse me?
Nothing. Somebody's trying to call in on this line.
I'm sorry about that, Tom.
Let's
go to line four for Ina. You're on the air with Tom Hayden.
Hi. Thank you again, Bob McChesney, for another interesting program. And what an honor to talk to one of the Chicago Seven.
Eight.
Thanks for all your activism over the years. I heard you once on a TV talk show saying how the former governor of Gray Davis did himself in with his with the recall of Gray Davis. He kind of betrayed his own Democratic base by cutting a secret deal with the corrupt utility companies. And you've kind of already talked about this a little in the beginning here, how Obama in particular should listen to the progressive base and the real Democratic base of the party. I'd like to ask you what your opinion would be if Obama or even McCain to have a kind of a reversal of the secrecy policies to kind of open up the government again, as they did after a little bit after the Nixon administration, to try to have an open window or open door, or less secrecy in government actions. And thank you again.
Well, I think your reference historically is a very good one. There was a moment as a result of the 60s and Watergate when there was a flurry of activity. The Congress took up new ways to do oversight of the CIA, the FBI. Millions of documents were declassified, and it ended with the Carter loss to Reagan, of course. So that's where we have to start again. I think under Obama, there'll be more declassification on the natural. Without getting into specifics, I think his notion that the only way to get change is from the bottom up, to mobilize people, to bring them into the process, to put hearings on C-SPAN. It sounds kind of superficial, but it's an example. Will lead him to do everything he can to make the governing process more open, less closed. I don't know if that's true about McCain. He's shown some instincts in that direction as well. But with this FISA vote, he's kind of sent a chill through a lot of supporters, and I think he probably needs to say something about how radically different and open the process will be under an Obama presidency. He's already done FISA, and before that exempted himself from the campaign finance regulations. So he has some ground to gain back here, and I hope that he realizes that his image has been somewhat damaged by this last couple of weeks.
Our guest today in Media Matters is Tom Hayden, who you've just been listening to. Author, commentator, former state senator, and co-founder of SDS going back five decades. The number here at Media Matters, if you want to call in, is 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Tom Hayden, I'd like to talk for a second, if I can, about the 60s. The last caller mentioned the Chicago 8, of which you remember. And I gather you're writing a book on that experience now?
No, I have written, but I've edited a book that's just out. It's called The Voices of the Chicago Eight. It's based on a play that was done first in Sacramento in 1979, and I've seen it performed several times. I think it's the best boiling down of the drama of the Chicago conspiracy trial that I've seen, and it can be used by community theaters and by campus theaters. I've seen it, for instance, out your way, performed at Central Michigan University this year, and it was sold out. You know, 500 people going every night for five nights, and I think it's quite an educational tool. This is the 40th anniversary, so typically the media asks for the comparisons. I think Chicago remains, I guess, a symbolic watershed, a kind of a passion play for all the contradictions of the 60s. There are some questions unanswered. I'm still not clear from the record, including the disclosures, how much the White House and the FBI and the CIA played a role in directing what Mayor Daley did with the police and the denial of permits for the demonstrators.
Yeah, Tom, before
and how much it was a local action by Mayor Daley. I will be out there August 7th for a big conference of journalism educators with Jeff Greenfield and Sam Brown to try to dwell a little more deeply on what Chicago meant then and what it means to us now. That'll be at the Marriott in Chicago on the morning of the 7th of August.
You know, Tom, for some of our younger listeners, or less educated, or both, less familiar with the situation, could you explain what we're talking about, the Chicago Democratic Convention, what happened there, and what the Chicago 8 trial was all about?
Well, how much time do I have? It's kind of like the 60s. You know, it's a blur to people as, was it sex, drugs, rock and roll revolution? What was it? And there's a struggle, I think, that is important, without getting bogged down in the past, to clarify that these were important struggles and that they should not be reduced to an image of, don't go there, it was all kind of crazy. Chicago was, the Chicago we're speaking of was a protest planned primarily against the war in Vietnam, coupled with a festival of life, something like what Woodstock the next year came to be. They were planned for the Democratic Convention in 68 during the time that the Democrats were continuing the war in Vietnam and the party machinery was controlled from the top down so that it would result in Hubert Humphrey continuing the war policies of Lyndon Johnson. That's how it appeared. And the protesters, myself among them, wanted permits to sleep in the park, wanted permits to demonstrate in the streets. There was certainly a crazy side. I mean, when Abby Hoffman said that, you know, we're going to put LSD in the Lake Michigan, or Jerry Rubin said the most important thing to do is to kill your parents, it did become a bit difficult to explain to the mainstream media, but we had the Justice Department negotiators on our side. They thought we deserved permits, and in the end, the permits were denied, and you had 20,000 police, National Guard, CIA, FBI, even U.S. troops fresh back from Vietnam on the streets of Chicago, To try to suppress dissent altogether. And so it became not just anti-war, anti-racism, or anti the Democratic Party machinery, but it became a struggle that had more to do with the survival of First Amendment rights when they were being denied. And I was beaten up a couple of times during the week. It was just to demonstrate was to take a big risk. And about 650 people were arrested, most of them, by the way, from Chicago with no previous police backgrounds. 60 or 70 reporters were beaten up or gassed or punched in the stomach like Dan Rather. It was a nightmare. And then we were indicted the year later by the Nixon administration in 69, and the trial started in the fall of 69 and went into February 1970. It was a trial about everything that happened in the 60s. The jury divided. Four of them thought we were innocent on all charges. Eight thought we were guilty on all charges. And then they thought they were being forced to compromise. So they flipped, and the ones that thought we were innocent said we were guilty, and the ones who said we were guilty said we were innocent. So we were freed on one charge, convicted on the other, and then eventually thwarted the whole prosecution on appeal with the Seventh Circuit court in the early to mid-70s. Federal courts let us off. So it was a long, long seven or eight-year process, and as it ended, which teaches us never to predict or be too pessimistic, as it ended, the people that were trying to put us in jail were being driven from office or going to jail themselves. Nixon, Agnew, John Mitchell, and so on. That's that time when there was a brief opening in 73 for a lot of possible reform.
You know, in preparation for this show, Tom Hayden, I went back and I reread the Port Huron Statement.
Yes.
Which was a document which I think if you didn't author, you co-authored or participated in writing.
No, I wrote it, and then it was redrafted in a convention of 65 people, and then they gave it back to me to polish. That's roughly how it happened.
And it's a document that's easily accessible on the Internet for anyone listening to the show, and was the founding document, as I recall, of Students for a Democratic Society. And it's an extraordinary statement still to this day. Reading it again, I found that it ages very well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I leave it to your audience. I get about one email a week from some student who asks, they're working on a paper on Port Huron or Vietnam. So it is out there. I think the essential spirit of it was to go from the kind of democracy we have now, which is more or less top-down, depending on politicians, to a form of democracy that we called participatory democracy, in which, yes, there are elections, but the scope of democratic possibilities is much wider than the ballot box.
You know, what else was interesting to me as I reread it, Tom, was that in addition to having all the necessary and understandable political critique and programs, it had something that was special to the 60s that much of our politics has lost since then, which is a vision of creating a world in which people are happier and more fulfilled lives, not simply programs about housing or employment, but it's really a vision of a happier humanity, a very optimistic view in that sense. And I came of age slightly after you in the 70s, when that was sort of looked down upon as being sort of hippy-dippy.
Well, things were pretty bleak at the end of the 60s. This,
yeah.
Port Huron was written in the most optimistic of moments at the very beginning of the 60s, before the murders. You know, just everything was possible. Let me tell you a story, for example. The first thing I got involved in, I was a student editor, was promotion of the idea of the Peace Corps. I wrote a speech and read it. It was 19 single-space, double-space pages. That was part of a planning group that was trying to get this to happen. And one night after seeing an especially disturbing movie on nuclear war, we wrote a little letter in Ann Arbor, it's October 1960, to Nixon and Kennedy. And it was about disarmament, but included was an alternative to military conscription, some kind of Peace Corps. So we got a guy in our group, Dave McLeod, who went looking for Kennedy when he came to the campus on the night of October 10th or 11th, and he found his way to a Kennedy activist with her little straw hat, and he explained himself, and she said, well, the senator's coming down this hallway in a few minutes, and you can give him this letter. So McLeod did so. He handed it to Kennedy. Kennedy read it, put it in his pocket, and said, I'll speak to one of those points later tonight. And then he went out in the rain at 11 o'clock at night, and he gave a speech advocating the Peace Corps. So that's the kind of time it was, never to be repeated probably, but it gave you this illusion, healthy illusion, that life could get better, that you could actually accomplish things. And the Port Huron Statement was about democracy, yes, but the goal of the democracy was to allow people to lead more fulfilling lives.
And, you know, the 60s, Tom Hayden, as you know better than anyone, has been a source of controversy ever since the 60s and remains so today. And now with the 5 decades of distance between us and the 1960s, scholars have weighed in repeatedly. And, you know, what is your take on how we should regard the 60s? What's the best way to grasp the experience America went through during that decade and what we should learn from it? What's important about it?
Well, we shouldn't dwell on it. I mean, I live in 2008, and I work every day against the war in Iraq, and I teach classes and so on. But you're perfectly right that there's a dispute over memory, and there's like 3 camps. One, people that want to remember it fondly and see it as the basis for role models or models for future social movements. The second group wants to erase it completely. We know who they are. And the third group, is the most problematic, I call the politicians of memory, the people who want to manipulate the image of the 60s to make it seem, good things were incorporated. We have a postage stamp for Cesar Chavez. We have a holiday for Martin Luther King. Things are much better as a result of the 60s. And they draw a line against the, what they call the darker excesses of the 60s, drugs and violence and so on. So the 60s becomes further proof that this is a great country because it can reform itself. Now, the truth is elusive, but these are the choices we have to make, and it seems to me people need to read and make up their own minds. But what I draw from it is this idea, and I'll just be very brief, that the 60s began mysteriously, that is, unexpected, unpredicted. No professor or pundit said it was going to happen. It was only noticed later. It grew out of discontent in the 50s, the anti-colonial movements, the Beat Generation, the beginning of the civil rights movement in Little Rock and Montgomery, and then it burst. This is what's interesting. It burst open for a period of about 8 to 10 or 12 years, depending on how you measure, and this is something like the Big Bang, but there was some kind of interaction that made this happen globally. Nobody wants to mention that. It happened everywhere in the world. Yes, differently in different countries, but everywhere in the world. So I think it must have had something to do with what the Obama generation might be feeling today. You know, when Barack Obama says, don't settle for the status quo, it's very reminiscent of what we were going through when we were 18 or 20, of whether we would settle for the world that our parents had accepted. We were hard on our parents, but that's the way it was. And people who refused to settle struck out on very bold trajectories, you know, the civil rights movement, the student movement, the Beat Generation, the literary explosions, Rachel Carson's book kind of crystallized the environmental movement. And we went from the margins to the mainstream through a lot of turmoil and suffering, but we did make it to the mainstream and might have made it farther if it wasn't for the murders of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King that just incapacitated our generation. We might actually have elected a government on a progressive platform, might have ended the Vietnam War earlier, might have addressed poverty and racism earlier. And yet, many great things came out of it. The civil rights legislation, the voting rights legislation, the end of Jim Crow in the South, the introduction of women's rights and women's equality measures, the first environmental laws after Earth Day, the fairness doctrine in the media, as you well know, the declassification of information, the end of the Indochina War, the end of the draft. I could make a list of 30 or 40 accomplishments, and then started the counter movement to prevent the accomplishments from going further, contain them, defund them. The attacks on Roe v. Wade are an example. The FISA controversy today stems from anti-domestic spying laws that were passed in the wake of the 70s. The hubbub about the War Powers Act today is an ongoing response.
Tom Hayden, let me stop you if I can at this moment, because we have one caller who's been waiting for a long time. We've only got a minute left in the show, so I want to give them an opportunity. Caller, line one, you're on the air with Tom Hayden.
Hi. Yeah, I was just going to ask if there was a parallel to a couple years ago, there was a bankruptcy bill, which, in my opinion, is probably more responsible for people losing their homes now than most other things. If there's a parallel to that, if there's any talk of repealing that now, just kind of some general stuff on that.
Tom?
Yes. To the surprise of the Republicans and maybe the Democrats, all this mysticism about, the economic bubble and our having transcended the business cycle of boom and bust is nonsense. It's broken down. I don't know if the Democrats have answers, but that's what this election is going to rest on. And it seems to me the starting point for any answer is to embrace the 1930s New Deal and update it to the information age. That would mean much more of a role for government in the stabilization of the economy, in preventing bankruptcies through government intervention and re-regulation. And I don't know if the Democrats are up to that, but it's time more for a Franklin D. Roosevelt than a John Kennedy or a Bill Clinton, it seems to me.
Yeah, so far Obama has sort of sent, at best, mixed signals on that, would you say?
I don't think he was planning on it. I mean, we were still in this phase where, remember, the Clintons had promoted NAFTA as a solution to our woes and the deregulation of the savings and loans and the telecommunications deregulation. It was supposed to be this myth of, if you could return to a market economy dominated by these big corporations, there would be an explosion of growth and everybody would benefit. And we were all kind of
Tom, I'm being given
marginalized in that discussion. Right now, it's all come home to roost.
Tom Hayden, I hear that it's time for us to close up shop. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today in Media Matters.
Thank you, my friend.
And I'm Bob McChesney. We'll be back one week from today, and I want to thank Colleen Cook for being the producer today. See you later.